meeting out there, but if you can't hear or something, then shout or wave your hands and we'll try and make a plan. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the Square Kilometre Array project in Africa and in South Africa in particular, and tell you something about what is the SKA. I think most people have probably heard about the SKA by now, the Square Kilometre Array, a big radio telescope that we're building here. Why is Africa interested in the SKA? I mean, that's quite a good question. Africa, the sort of dark continent, not much going on, digging minerals out of the ground, and suddenly we're bidding to host a premier scientific instrument. So quite a change in the sort of scope of what Africa can do. Well, how did we respond to the SKA challenge? I'll tell you about that. And then the SKA project itself, the international project, how is it being organized? We'll talk a little bit about that. There's some various sort of precursor activities happening at the moment in the Karoo, in the site that we've established, a telescope called CAT-7 that we've already built, the Meerkat telescope that we're busy building as a precursor to the SKA, and then the SKA will follow on from that. And then lastly, some other programs and things that may be of interest which you probably aren't aware of, or perhaps you are, some of them extending right up into Africa. Okay, so the SKA is planned as being the world's largest and most sensitive radio telescope. It's an international project. It spans countries, research institutes. It really has something that's been born global. So it's not some idea that's just sort of surfaced in a corner of the world. It kind of surfaced in a number of different places at once. People realized that they could only get sort of so far with the kind of astronomy they were doing with radio astronomy. And they needed more sensitivity. And the way you get more sensitivity is you build a bigger dish or an array of dishes in this case. It turns out you can't build one enormous dish. It becomes sort of mechanically restrictive. It's too hard to get the dish to point accurately, and it becomes very expensive. So what people do now instead is they build an array of dishes, so a whole lot of small dishes put together with a computing backend to build a very big telescope. Okay, the SKA is funded by several member countries. I've got a list of them sort of coming up in a slide in a moment. It's about 10 of those at the moment, and we hope that a couple more will join, and we hope that also in the future the USA in particular will join the SKA effort. It requires sort of, will provide extreme sensitivity, but it also requires a very excellent radio quiet location. So there was a whole process that's been running for many years around that. It was shortlisted down to South Africa and Australia, and both of which have very excellent sites for radio astronomy. In the sort of western deserts of Australia is a very quiet location because there aren't many humans around there. And similarly in the Northern Cape, we've got some really excellent location for radio astronomy and also optical astronomy, as you know, with the SALT telescope and the activities at Sutherland. Okay, so the SKA is going to take quite a long time. It's a big project, probably another sort of 10 years or so at least until the SKA is built, maybe a bit longer. There'll be two phases currently envisaged, phase one and a phase two. Phase one is a kind of a 10% of the total telescope, and it's going to be this iconic project that people will look at for a long time. Okay, just something about why we're doing this kind of thing. Why are astronomers interested in sort of building big telescopes and sort of looking back further in time? Light and radio waves, by the way, radio waves are not sound waves. We should just make that clear up front. A radio wave is just like a light wave, but it's at a lower frequency. So it's like a different color of light wave, if you like. It's the same thing that when you tune your car radio, you're picking up radio waves, but they're not actually sound waves that your aerial detects. It's a signal that's been encoded with a sound signal that gets converted into sound in your car. But the actual thing that travels through space is an electromagnetic wave that travels at the speed of light. Okay, so that's what we're detecting, and it's kind of in those radio regions that you would detect in your car, but spanning a sort of a broader range than that. So what astronomers have discovered sort of in recent times is that we don't know very much about the universe. We thought with our new instruments we were making great progress, we were understanding more and more, but it turns out that the more carefully we've looked at the universe, we realize that we actually understand less and less. So for example, there's 74% of the universe, as you can see up on the slide, labeled as dark energy. Okay, and dark energy is labeled as dark energy because we don't know what it is, so we call it dark energy. People don't really have any handle on what dark energy is. It's some sort of force that is causing the universe to expand more and more rapidly over time. So it's kind of accelerating outwards, and we don't really have a good idea, or in fact really any idea, about what dark energy is. So we can study the effect, we can look at how galaxies are moving away from each other, but it's very hard to know what the mechanism is for that. There's another big slice of that pie called dark matter, which is a whole lot of sort of matter that's exerting a gravitational effect on galaxies that we can observe and things, but it's not the normal kind of matter that we know about, the matter that makes up our bodies, the matter that makes up gas and stars and things. It's not that kind of matter, so we call it dark matter. We're not quite sure what kind of particles these are, which only seem to interact sort of through gravity. All right, just a bit more on the science side of things. So that plot up on the top left shows a sort of schematic of the expanding universe from the time of the Big Bang at the very top, going up, down below here. We can detect signals from the very early part of the universe. There's a satellite called WMAP which detected the cosmic microwave background and made some very sensitive measurements of this. It's a very uniform radiation field that, in fact, is all around us. But if you point very accurately and carefully and take very precise measurements at different parts of the sky, you can see that, in fact, it's not smooth. It has certain kind of lumps and things in it. And we think that these lumps from the early part of the universe, just after the Big Bang, were, in fact, the things that eventually led to galaxies and stars and things forming. So the universe, if it was completely smooth, there probably would be no structure. There would be no bodies, no you and I sitting here in this lecture theater. It needed some kind of lumpiness in it so that matter could start gathering together under gravity and forming the structures that we see today. Okay, in terms of SKS science, I've got a little video that I'm going to show. So let's hop over to that. So this is a very short video on the SKS science, and hopefully it'll give you some kind of idea about what the SK is hoping to measure as some of its key science projects. In addition to that, we expect a lot of new science to come out of the SK, just because of the fact that we've got amazing sensitivity with that new radio telescope, and new things and new techniques will be developed, which could be tried out on the new instrument. Okay, the schematic represents two black holes in orbit around each other and the gravitational waves that would be theorized to come from that. And this represents something called a pulsar orbiting around a black hole and the distortions in space-time that would come from that. The SK is going to study sort of many different kinds of phenomena. magnetic fields is one of the areas of great interest. So how did magnetic fields get established in space? What's maintaining them? And what is their structure? This part of the video shows the sort of the molecules that might go up into making life. So you can study with a radio telescope the kinds of molecules that are in space that might eventually, if they come together in the right kind of ways, form living material or living beings, if you like. These are just some of the technologies of the SKA. So you saw their dishes and these kind of flat structures, a number of different things. There was supposed to be some speaking going on with that video, but it seems to have disappeared in showing it, so never mind. All right, so let's hop back here. So, as was shown in the video, a number of different areas of SKA science. The expansion of the universe, why is it expanding quicker than we thought? Something called the epoch of reionization on the top right, which is a very early part of the universe. And people are trying to detect the signals that are theorized to come from that part. Basically, when the first stars started turning on, so the matter collapsed enough under gravity so that the stars started shining and ionizing the gas around it, and we expect to be able to detect signals from that. Okay, so you've seen a number of different kinds of technologies already in the video. This is what an SKA dish might look like, sort of artistic view. It won't look exactly like this, but this is known as an offset Gregorian dish, which is something that we're building for the Meerkat radio telescope, a precursor to the SKA. These are something called the dense aperture arrays, something that's very computer intensive. Each of these little elements down here in the bottom, in fact, is an antenna, and they all have kind of data streams coming out of them. So to process this thing, it doesn't have any movable parts, but you can electronically, via your computing, steer your beams around the sky. So you form the beams and steer it as to where you want to look at. So you could have a number of different observations going on at once, in different kind of directions, all simultaneously, but limited by the amount of computing that you've got available. These are different kinds of antennas, a sort of low frequency antenna, which does a similar job to what I've just described, but at lower frequencies. Okay, so some of you might be sort of fairly new to radio astronomy. I'm sure almost everybody is. Just to explain what the difference between radio and optical observations are. With a radio telescope and with an optical telescope, you can produce images of the sky. Now, this may not be very obvious to people, but you can make a radio picture of the sky just as you can look up with your eyes and see stars at night. You can look up and see radio structures. But of course you need special kind of eyes. So you need a radio telescope that provides you those eyes, because your physical eyes can't see at radio wavelengths. Okay, so that's why you need different kinds of antennas, different kind of computing, whatever, to produce the images. But you can still make images. So what we've got on the left-hand side is an image of the gas surrounding a galaxy. And it's been sort of color-coded so that the gas that's moving away from us is colored in red on the bottom there, and the gas that's coming towards us is in blue. And you can detect the motion of the gases by the slight shifts in the frequency that we observe the gas at. And so from this we can see that this whole galaxy is actually rotating around. And by studying the rotation we can work out how much matter is in that galaxy, something about the dark matter distribution around there. So you can make quite an interesting picture of the hydrogen gas around a galaxy and see what's actually going on around there. The picture on the right is a combination of a radio and optical, but put together in one picture. So the white stuff are things that you would see with a normal optical telescope. The orange are the radio telescope emissions that you would detect. So in this case, it's the interaction of a jet, probably a black hole that sits in the middle of that galaxy, has a jet going out in both directions, left and right, which interacts with a very sort of faint gas around that galaxy and excites the gas, produces radio waves that we then detect. And so this is something very real, that if you looked up at the sky right now with radio eyes, you'd be able to detect these kind of structures. Okay, so don't think this is just sort of people making it up or pie in the sky or whatever. These are kind of real things you can observe. Okay, so why have we tried to attract the SKA to Africa? Why go to all this effort? I mean, it was a very intense competition. Let's not say too much more about it. But the sort of the sight competition with Australia was very taxing. And it took a fairly dedicated team a large amount of day and night effort to kind of pull this thing off. And why did we bother? Well, to attract a very large telescope like the radio, like the SKA, it's an iconic project. It attracts people to the country. It excites people. We fill up lecture theatres. I mean, if you look around here, you hear right now this room is full. There's a reverse brain drain effect that's starting to happen. We're starting to get people that have left the country, highly skilled people, wanting to come back, applying for jobs within the project and around the project at the universities in our research programs and things. So there's a very positive aspect to hosting a large instrument in the country. An instrument like the SKA, you can actually operate from anywhere. It will be something that's by internet connections and things. You'll be able to run the telescope, see what's going on. But there's a very big draw card to actually physically having the instrument in your country. People like to actually go and visit the site, see what's going on, feel part of the action. The government has been incredibly supportive of the SKA in the country and continues to do so, has allocated substantial funds towards the project and towards the precursor projects. And they do that for a very good reason. It's a flagship project. It creates a kind of a benign focus. In the past, we had sort of other focuses, maybe the arms industry and other things. Now, astronomy is a kind of benign focus for the cutting-edge technology, the newest developments, establishing exciting skills programs around the country at all levels, sort of from the university professorship levels right down to a sort of technician training. I shouldn't say down, but the full spectrum of things. People involved in the SKA doing operations, doing the most sort of exquisite science with the instrument. So the SKA in Africa will look something like this. It will be located in the Northern Cape. Sort of two-thirds of the telescope will come to Africa and one-third to Australia. The two-thirds that are in Africa, the sort of dish component, will look something like this. So in the Northern Cape, a very large concentration of antennas there. These dots are obviously drawn much bigger than the actual area that will be covered. But then you can see stations of antennas going up through Africa, up into Ghana, Kenya, Madagascar, even in Mauritius. So the SKA in Africa will be a substantial undertaking with many, many countries involved. So what the government did to support this is establish something called SKA South Africa, which is a project with funded by the Department of Science and Technology and administered by the National Research Foundation. The idea of this project was to compete initially for the SKA sighting. It was then decided, no, we must build some precursor technology as well. So we can't just provide land or raw resources. We actually want to be involved in the technology too. So we're building the Meerkat, the radio telescope, 64 dishes. And we've built a very large skills training program, which has been sort of very well funded as well. This project is also now one of the presidential infrastructure projects. So recently, if you sort of take any notice of the sort of political speeches and things, you'll notice that the president announced a whole infrastructure development program. The SKA is now being sort of classed as one of those projects. So just to show you something about the Human Capital Development Program, the so-called Youth into Science program. We have a bursary conference that runs over several years, or each year we run this conference, and you can see a kind of growth in student numbers over the years. I think at the moment we've awarded something like 450 grants at different levels of support to students, right from undergrad, even FET trainings and things, right up to university chairs with associated PhDs. This is a very successful program, and there's a continued growth in the numbers. The SKA International Organization is something that's now based in Jodrell Bank, which is a very large telescope there, the Lovell Telescope, which has been doing radio astronomy for many years. And so any of you that have links to the UK will be probably aware of Jodrell Bank. There's a new building that's just been built, and a new organization has been set up, funded by the international members, the member countries for the SKA, and now starting to work with the two partner countries, or the two host countries, and everyone around the world who's also involved with the SKA development to establish this project and get it all off the ground. So it's a company, it's a not-for-profit company, it has a board of directors, and all the usual things that are required in order to sort of pull together an international endeavor of this kind of scale. Currently, the countries that have listed there, the Netherlands, Australia, New Zealand, UK, Canada, South Africa, China, Sweden, Italy, and Germany has recently joined. And India is currently also an associate member and is expected to become a full member quite soon. You can see a few missing names there maybe, and in particular the USA. I think the SK in future would like to see the USA join the whole endeavor. All right, so the site decision, the SK is, you probably saw from the videos, is not really kind of one telescope. There's different kinds of antennas that are needed to observe at the different frequencies. And so the sort of decision of the SK organization, after a whole lot of deliberation and competition, the recommendation of the sort of site selection committee went towards the African bid. But in the interests of sort of inclusiveness and ensuring that Australia and New Zealand, who had put in a large amount of effort and time and money into developing their site as well, that this was well used, the telescope has been split between the two regions. So for the first phase, there's something called the low frequency array, which will exist in Australia. The mid frequency array, which is the dishes, will be in South Africa. And then there's a second kind of dish instrument growing out from the Australia's precursor known as ASCAP, known as the SKA sort of survey instrument, which should also happen in Australia in the first phase. In the second phase, sort of, which is a much larger build in the second phase, so remember phase one is kind of 10% of the instrument. Phase two, the low frequency part continues to be built out in Australia, and then the mid frequency, and then there's something called the mid frequency aperture arrays, so the dishes and the aperture arrays come to Africa. Don't worry too much about all the technology about aperture arrays and survey instruments and things. It's not terribly important. Just to show that the SK is actually, it's a fairly kind of complex endeavor in terms of technologies and splits and politics and various other things. So why are we putting this thing in Africa? Well, this is a population density map of South Africa. The blue is and the red is where all the people are and the greens and things. And you can probably see fairly clearly that the Northern Cape is mostly where the people aren't. And that's either because they drew the boundary after they decided where the people live or threw them out afterwards, we're not quite sure. But we all know that that's a desert region. So it's a region of sheep farming, very large farms, very sparsely populated, quite a harsh environment, and good for astronomy. This region here that's been identified is part of our sort of geographic advantage area, which is protected by government legislation. So in fact, if there's certain transmissions in the area, let's say a cell phone operator wants to put up a new mast or they've got some existing mast that will interfere with the telescope because it's transmitting in that direction, we can actually go to use this act of government to get them to alter their transmissions in a way that won't affect the telescope. So effectively, we're protecting the resources of the natural resources of the Karoo for astronomy in that area. The same applies to the Sutherland area and the SALT telescope and the other telescopes there. Okay, so the reason why we put it there, you can probably see this is a picture showing a lot of space with a little cluster of dishes in the middle. Okay, this little cluster of dishes in the middle is something called Cat7, which is what we've built already. Each of those dishes is about 12 meters in diameter, so it's actually, they're fairly substantial. But you can see the vast space around here, which is some of the area in which we'll put SKA dishes. So once that space fills up, and this is a sort of artistic rendition of the thing, you'll see a sort of a core of dishes in that area looking something like this. So a couple of thousand dishes in the area, in that core region. Okay, so Meerkat, let me play another video, which hopefully has some commentary this time. In fact, I think this other one only has music. Meerkat is a precursor telescope that we've been developing here in Cape Town, in fact, and in Johannesburg. We have two offices. We have a third office in Carnarvon. Our main engineering offices are just right here in Pinelands next to Vincent Pilotti Hospital. And a lot of the design work and engineering work for Meerkat is happening there. So things like specifying the antennas, how they will work, the operating sort of limits and things, the computing, all kinds of things are happening just here in Cape Town. So it's a local project. It's now going to be incorporated into the international SKA project as well. So once we've finished building Meerkat, we expect there'll be some phase of integration into the SKA, the details of which are quite tricky, and we still need to agree with the international organization. So quite a lot of sort of behind the scenes work happening there on the technical front and the sort of political and agreements legal side to work out how Meerkat will be incorporated into the SKA and sort of be counted as part of our contribution towards the SKA. It's 64 dishes. It's spread over an area of about 8 kilometers. It has a certain kind of frequency coverage listed there, so 580 megahertz up to about 14 gigahertz. And we expect this thing to be in place in the Karoo around about 2016, after which we should operate it with its science programs. There's a lot of science interest in Meerkat, international science interest, and certain time's been allocated on Meerkat, and then there'll be a phased transition into SKA. So let me show you a Meerkat video. Okay, this is very, very short as well. Sorry, very marketing kind of oriented, but that was during the heated times of the site bid. So, okay. But it does give you some idea of what how Meerkat will look and the kinds of operations. We've got this sort of on-site processor building that's been constructed. I'll show you in a moment. This is actually more closer to the dish design that we're actually adopting now. So it's known as an offset Gregorian dish. The signals from space basically come in at an angle, let's say from the top left here, coming down onto the dish. They bounce off this big reflecting surface here, which will be sort of aluminium panels. They bounce off a secondary reflector over here and then go to something known as the feed over there, which actually is like your real kind of antenna. It's like your antenna on your car. That's sort of inside the feed. But it's a very specialized thing here that runs at very low temperatures to produce very low noise, because we don't want to contaminate the sort of the signal that we're trying to detect, which is extremely weak, with actual noise of the electronics. And then this whole dish moves around in different directions. So there you can see it's sort of, this one would be where you're observing straight up on the left-hand side here. So signals coming in directly from overhead. And you can see the sort of angle here, which makes it a bit confusing if you're not quite sure how the optics works here. And then here you would be observing effectively sort of down at the horizon, or very close to the horizon. In fact, I think about 15 degrees up from there. Okay, I'm not going to go into the technical details of Meerkat in any kind of extent, just to say there's a lot of electronics and computing and things behind that. So it's not just a matter of dishes. The dishes are the very visible part, the bit that politicians come and sort of cut the ribbons around and things. But there's a lot of other parts to the telescope. In fact, the most important parts for this kind of telescope lie in the computing area, in the algorithms, in the processing, and all kinds of things that happen behind the scenes to pull all the signals from the different dishes together to do the science you want to do. All right, so some of the work that we've done in the Karoo, the Cat-7 telescope's over here. The town of Carnarvon's about 80 kilometers away over here. We've got a support base over there. This is currently a gravel road running all the way to the site, which we're thinking we'll probably have to upgrade to a tar road for the SKA. And then zooming in on this side of things, Meerkat will be over there next to Cat-7, the site complex here. And just getting a bit closer, so the site complex at the bottom here, we've got this nice flat-topped hill which provides radio screening at the bottom to keep our site complex, which is some of those buildings, to keep them from contaminating the signals at the telescopes themselves. So as soon as we've got human activity or computing or lights or all kinds of things that you take for granted when you're in the city, they potentially can cause problems for a radio telescope. They can be sort of seen as noisy. So just as you don't want to put your optical telescope in a place where there's a lot of light pollution, for a radio telescope you don't want to put it in a place where there's radio pollution. So Meerkat, once it's built, all the dishes will be sort of distributed in this kind of fashion, which looks fairly random, but there's some sort of method to the madness, if you like. It's designed to do certain kinds of science, and that's why it's laid out in that way. We recently flew over the site when we took some visitors there. So this is the flat-topped hill. And then you can just see on the bottom right-hand side here, that's the Cat-7 array, and Meerkat will be built out in this region over here, and SKA as well. And the site complex is behind this hill over here. It's a very pretty place to visit, and if you walk up on top of the hill at sunset and you look down, that's what you see. It's very nice, so I just put that in. This is the road layout for Meerkat, where you can see a sort of distribution of the antennas. This green road here and the white strip here is a landing strip that we're putting in. Currently we do fly to site. We originally used to drive and it took 8 hours to get there, which is a lot of engineering time to be spending in a car. Now we have a charter flight that goes from Cape Town Airport to the town of Carnarvon, but then there's still an hour and a half or so to get to the site from there. So what we're doing is we're building a landing strip right on the site, and you should be able to then to get from Cape Town or from Johannesburg to the site within about an hour and a half and land on the site. Of course, when the telescope's doing kind of its observations and things in the future, you won't be landing planes at the same time, because the plane's likely to also interfere with the radio observations. Okay, so looking at the road layout from the air, so that what we saw previously was the plans, now it's actually being built. These roads are all happening as we speak, and towards the end of this year, the various kind of infrastructure for Meerkat should be all in place. Not the dishes though, but all the roads and the foundations, or some of the foundations towards the end of this year. So what the site complex will look like is something like this, an underground processor building over here, which is under construction, a dish integration shed, another big shed which we're extending for sort of manufacture of dishes. We've got a small amount of on-site accommodation here, and some various sort of shelter and things for containers and things that we have on site currently, which we're using for running the Cat-7 system. So once again, flying over from the air, this big mountain here, well, it looks like a rather strange structure, is all the earth that was dug out of the earthworks with the new buildings being built. And we decided to arrange this in a kind of an earth wall here, or what we call a berm, which in fact provides additional radio frequency screening in the direction of the telescope out in this direction towards the top. So the reason we made this wall was to effectively also reduce radio noise coming from this area where we will have equipment and some people in the direction of the telescope. So as you can see, we're fairly paranoid about what kinds of things happen in the Karoo and how the radio noise is controlled. This is the site building progress, so just a couple of pictures, big holes in the ground where the new processor building, the data center, is being built. This is from November, and you can see the new structure emerging where we'll put our computing for Meerkat and for SKA Phase 1. So this building will hold something like 150 or 130 racks worth of equipment. If any of you know what a computing rack is, it's something that sort of stands about so high and about this wide, and you populate it full of computers. Not the kind of desktop boxes that we're used to in the past, or laptops, but kind of servers that slide in, and they're about so thick. and you can fit about 40 of them into one of these racks. And then you have 130 of those racks, and you fill a room full of those. And then, of course, it gets very hot, so you need to provide air conditioning for that, and power, and then you can't have the computer switching off when the power fails, so you need redundant power as well. So we've got all kinds of mechanisms to provide that, and rotary generators and things. So this building contains not only data racks and computers, but it also contains, more importantly, or very importantly, redundant power supplies, and also the air conditioning systems. So you can see it's quite a large operation, and it uses a reasonable amount of electricity as well to run such a facility when it's fully populated with equipment. Yeah, that's a very good question. We had to create a power line where does the electricity come from for the site? So at the moment we've created a power line from the town of Carnarvon to the site, so covering those 80 kilometres or so, and it's a rather expensive endeavour to create such a thing. In future, for the sort of full SKA, we're probably going to have to create a second power line to the north, to almost create a sort of redundant power supply link as well to some existing sort of substations up there. In addition to that, we have diesel generators on site in case there's a problem with the line. So, yeah.
Signals sent by line fiber from each telescope, and we need additional electrical signals to control the telescope.
That's right, yeah. Okay, so all good questions. I think we'll have a bit more time for questions in a few minutes. But the question there was really, are the signals and things coming from the dishes and the control electronics and things that we need on the dishes and the cooling systems on the dishes not going to interfere with the very observations that we're trying to do? And yes, they potentially can interfere, and we take some very careful steps to ensure that they don't interfere. So a lot of measurements are done in the lab on the kinds of equipment and how we shield things and how we screen things and what signals are leaking between different subsystems. So it's a very tricky exercise to, in fact, get that all right. But it's something that has been done with other telescopes, and we have to do it, once again, very carefully for Meerkat. And it's something that changes over time as well, because you might do it for an existing telescope, you build it, and then you use new technology for the next telescope, and you've got to go through that whole exercise with the new technology. Okay, once again, a couple more pictures of the building itself being constructed, just walls going up and things. CAT-7 is the seven-dish system that I've talked about. It's busy up and running in the Karoo. It's got some scientific results coming out of it already, but we've largely used it as an engineering test bed to test these very kinds of things, like what interferes with what, how do we control the dishes, will the control unit in the dish interfere with our observations, that kind of thing. So it's been incredibly useful as a test bed, not only to help establish the site and prove that we can build and run things in the Karoo, but also from all the engineering side of things as well. Okay, so that is CAT-7 from the air, the seven dishes, each, as I say, about 12 meters in diameter. That's a big shipping container down there, which we did early observations from when we didn't have a link going all the way back to Cape Town. That's just a nice, pretty picture. It's a nice place to visit. At the moment, it's a construction site, so you can't really get to visit it, but in future times, you should be able to. We've built a lot of technology ready for running the CAT-7 system. This is something called the correlator, which is a whole bunch of computing. These are these computing racks I was talking about with different kind of servers. In this case, the servers are special servers that we've sort of developed within the project to do the high-speed first stage of computing in the correlator. So this has been an international collaboration with a number of universities and other research institutes. We find ourselves now in the lead of this and developing this technology, which is being exported around the world to other observatories. It's known as the Roach board, and that's kind of what it looks like in terms of technical stuff. You might get a fright if you're not used to what a computer looks like on the inside, but that's kind of what it does. And there's some very sort of high-speed computing and careful design involved in such a board. Okay, so we can start to do observations with CAT-7 and look at different things. One of these is a sort of a flaring structure. So it may not seem terribly significant to you, but this little dot in the middle here turns out to be a sort of a binary system it's thought to be a sort of a fairly compact neutron star about the size of Cape Town, about 20 kilometers in size, and a much bigger object, maybe the size of our Sun, in orbit around each other. And this orbit is not a, a sort of circular orbit, it's a kind of elliptical orbit. And every 16 and a half days, the two objects get close to each other, and the neutron star, because it's so dense and has such a high gravity, sucks material from the other object, the Sun, the kind of Sun object, and well, the star object, and that material, as it falls onto the neutron star, sort of gets very excited and emits radio waves, which you can detect. Not only radio waves, but X-rays and other frequencies as well. So by using different kinds of observatories, and here we used Cat7, we can look at this object in its sort of quiet state, which is the picture on the left, and then here you can see it's much brighter as the sort of 16 and a half days, or let's say during the flaring period, it's much brighter, and we can detect that with even a small instrument like Cat7. This big ring-like structure down at the bottom is not really what we were after, but that's a supernova remnant. So it's an exploded star, and this is the sort of gas and dust and things around that star that's still excited and emitting radio waves. All right, this is just to remind me to tell you when things will happen. So around about 2016, we expect MeerKAT, the 64 dishes, to be on the ground up and running, and we'll be starting to do the sort of the commissioning and early science observations 2017 or so. So in the period between about 2017 and 2020, 2021, we'd be expecting to do a large part of the MeerKAT science before the instrument gets sort of integrated into the SKA. Okay, we'll move on from that. We're doing a few other things as well in the Karoo. This is an experiment looking at the early part of the universe at low frequencies, a very different kind of antenna. There on the bottom right is the paper antenna. And it's established in the Karoo, and they're currently observing kind of at the moment. The array will be expanded, and it's hoped that if they can detect the signal they're after, that it'll be kind of Nobel Prize winning science. So this is a fairly a much more targeted experiment than building a large observatory. It's looking for one specific thing, so you build your instrument accordingly. You don't build it to do things it doesn't need to do. So you can see, in fact, some of the structure around the paper antennas. It's built from material that looks like it could come out of a swimming pool shop, like the tubes and whatever. And in fact, it could, some of it. But there's also some very careful design in here, and they're starting to do some very good science with paper. So our sort of role in this is to provide sort of on-site support, provide a site for the paper telescope, because our Karoo site is extremely radio quiet, and provide technical assistance to the people on the site, provide some project management, and using all of that and the people overseas in the US, paper is starting to produce very, very nice maps using us in the Southern Hemisphere, and then they've got a Northern Hemisphere site as well. We've got another experiment that's just starting up, which is called CBAS, which is to do a C-band, which is a kind of 5 gigahertz all-sky survey in support of some of the satellite missions to look to map the cosmic microwave background. So this, in fact, is a Telkom dish that we bought from Telkom for R1, which is very nice. In fact, we've got a couple of these things. One of them is at Heart of Beerswijk as well. The antennas that Telkom was no longer using, the R1 is a kind of a notional figure that one needs to put some value to these things so that they can be transferred without a kind of zero cost or whatever. But the condition of it was that we had to move these antennas from the Telkom site into the Karoo, which of course, you know, cost a lot more than R1. So these have been established ones at our support base in the Karoo, about 10 kilometers from the town of Carnarvon. Another one's up at Heart of Beerswijk. And we're starting this experiment now to do this all-sky survey. We have a different project called the African BLBI Network, which is an idea to take existing dishes that were used for telecommunications, much like those Telkom dishes, but in this case much bigger dishes, maybe 30-meter class dishes or so. So, for example, there's one in Ghana, a Vodafone dish, which we're now converting to be a radio telescope. So it's taking those existing dishes. They're no longer needed because of the fiber optic cables that have been put in around Africa. In fact, there's a huge amount of fiber optic cable going around Africa, much more than we know. And these have made these dishes redundant, but we can turn those into radio telescopes now and then use that very same fiber that's made the dishes redundant to get the data back to a central location and turn it into science results. It's also an excellent activity to build up skills around Africa in our partner countries, so that's where we're focusing right now, to build up a kind of support concept for the SK. So kind of a precursor for the SK, but very scientifically interesting in its own right, in order to build a very high resolution array using these existing dishes around Africa and linking to the telescopes in Europe. So the VLBI part of this stands for Very Long Baseline Interferometry, which sounds very complicated as well. And in fact, if you try and look at the techniques of that, it is pretty complicated. But really what it does is to use the telescope, spread them out as far as possible, and get very high resolution radio pictures of the thing that you're interested in. So that's the dish in Ghana. And then just to finish off, before we take a few questions, there's various sort of activities happening in this area. I've talked a lot about the SK and Meerkat, Cat 7. You've heard about the salts, and on the top left there you'll see the salt telescope in Sutherland. There's also a gamma ray telescope in Namibia known as HESS, and a new version of this. In fact, they've just upgraded HESS. I think there's a new big dish that's been added to it. And then there's a new project as well called the CTA, I think, which is the Cherenkov Telescope Array. And I believe that Namibia is also bidding to host that. So it's also a gamma ray telescope, and it will be a kind of successor to HESS. We've know about Meerkat, and we've heard about the SKA. And there's also various sort of satellite instruments that, of course, not only apply to this region, but all regions of the world. But combined with sort of, you can often get a detection on a satellite instrument that's maybe looking for X-rays or whatever. There's a flare somewhere, and then it can trigger the ground-based observations. So we're starting to look to enter more and more into an era where the instruments work together to give a more complete picture of the universe. So we're not just looking with our eyes, we're looking with our radio eyes as well, we're looking with our X-ray eyes, and we're really getting a much more detailed and comprehensive view of the different sort of physical processes in the universe. And in particular, Africa is establishing itself now very firmly as a kind of preferred destination for some of this instrumentation, not only because of our geographic sort of advantages in the area, but also because of the skills and things we've built up at the universities, in industry, and all around, and also due to the large sort of public support and support from government, support from the public in these kind of endeavors. So it really is a very, very exciting time for astronomy. And I don't think I really need to say much more about the conclusions. It's really to say that the SK winning the site bid is the sort of the start of it. There's an awful lot of work now that has to happen at all kinds of levels, technical, political, funding, legislation, legal, whatever. To make the SKA actually happen. It's not something that, oh well, okay, we've won it and now it's going to appear magically. There's teams that are working very hard here in this country but around the world to make the SKA happen. And it should be something very exciting to watch over the next decade or so. And we hope that it produces the magnificent science results and the technical results and the spin-offs and the excitement that people already associate with the project. So, thank you very much. Right, we have some questions. Yeah.
How does fracking interfere with your radio?
Okay, we've had the question on fracking. How does fracking interfere with the telescope? Fracking operations close to the telescope, if they involve a lot of sort of human activity and trucks driving around and things, could interfere with the telescope in terms of transmissions and things. So we wouldn't want any kind of fracking operations which are too close to the actual instrument itself. But when I say too close, I'm not talking about sort of hundreds of kilometers. You know, maybe it's 10 or 20 kilometers away. We wouldn't want something that's much closer than that. In terms of sort of vibrations in the ground and all that kind of thing, we're a radio telescope. It's not that sensitive to that kind of operation. I think certainly the optical side would be more likely to be sensitive to very kind of low level vibrations. I'm not going to try and even go into environmental impacts and that kind of thing because that's a very emotive issue. But we do have this legislation that, as I said, the Geographic Advantage Act that allows us to restrict what happens in the areas of the telescope to avoid any kind of interference in terms of operations. So if a fracking operation looks like it's going to interfere, we would have the power to get that shut down or moved or whatever.
What is the time scale? When do you expect SKA to be really operational?
Right, the time scale for SKA. So we expect that there's a design phase that's happening now that should run for the next few years. And we expect that SKA, so phase one construction, should happen from starting probably from around 2017, 2018, something like that. With maybe SKA phase one, let's say, ready by about 2021. These times are the sort of notional times at the moment, and it remains to be seen if they are actually achievable. And then the full SKA, the sort of the next 90% of the thing, would take probably another, you know, to the end of the 2020s, I'd say, to actually to build and get up and running. I think it's going to take a while. Okay, does each object in space emit a different frequency, and how do I measure how far away it is, or how does one measure? Objects in space emit, they have different kind of emission mechanisms, so certain kind of molecules will emit at a certain frequency, at certain kinds of gas clouds and things, but some objects emit over a very broad spectrum, so you can detect them with X-rays, with radio waves, with visible. It's just that the different the radiation intensity might be different at the different wavelengths. So it's a combination of things. Some emit at very specific frequencies, and some and it may be sort of several frequencies, and some emit a very broad range of frequencies. If they emit at specific frequencies and you know what that frequency should be, like let's say the hydrogen line which people use in radio astronomy, you know it should be at 1420 megahertz. Okay? So you look for this line, which is a fairly characteristic signal that you see in your data. You see it's actually shifted away. It will be at a lower frequency typically if you're looking at a very far away object. And by looking at the difference in frequency between where it is at rest and where you actually measure it, you can use the Hubble constant and things to work out how far away that object is. So that's a sort of a standard mechanism of sort of redshift that people use for measuring distances to objects.
Okay,
so Australia is one of the member countries of the SKA. They will be hosting a third of the telescope, roughly a third, and as I said, two-thirds in Africa. So they've also got very similar programs as we've been running here in terms of developing a site, developing a precursor instrument, in this case known as ASCAP, which is sort of complementary to Meerkat. So it has a very wide field of view rather than a very sort of sensitive and deep field of view. And they're engaged in kind of similar activities at the SKA level and in their country.
Some of the frequencies can only operate until they move enough, like optical and the sun appears too much. Some of the frequencies can operate 24 hours.
Yes, with a radio telescope, you can observe 24 hours for a lot of the work you're going to do. Sometimes the sun itself, because it's a very strong radio source, actually does get in the way of your observations. So you might want to do certain observations at night, but in general, when people design radio telescopes, they expect it to be operating 24/7, which is doesn't give your radio astronomers much rest, or the technicians and things. So for that reason, you have to sort of have fairly dedicated maintenance schedules and things, and blocks of time when certain dishes won't be available for maintenance. And it's a different kind of operation to an optical telescope. Yes, yeah. Okay, the question is on security. How are we going to secure this whole installation? It's a good question as well. It is firstly a very remote region. And the core region we already have security on site. So we've got a security company that sort of looks after what's on site. It's very hard to kind of get in and out of there without someone noticing you for a start, because it really is kind of at the end of the world. Where we have stations, kind of, let's say, I showed the picture earlier of Africa with the various dots around the place. There you'll have more sort of localized stations, and I think those will be fairly easy to secure, once again with some sort of perimeter fencing plus security guards and things. Of course, there will be some equipment that will need to be located there. But most of the sort of expensive equipment, I mean, it's not likely that somebody's going to walk up with a dish. You never know, but it's unlikely. But some of the computing equipment and things, I mean, that will be sort of locked away in buildings and whatever, and localized as well. Sorry, yes? In relation to funding, what contribution does South Africa have? Okay, so where's the money coming from? The money at the moment for the South African component of what we've done is taxpayers' money. It's money allocated to the Department of Science and Technology for development of these kind of programs. And that will continue to be the case also for the full SK, except the full SK is going to be funded by all the member countries, not in this case for Meerkat. Meerkat is being funded locally within South Africa from our national budgets. But the SK will be funded as a global endeavour, which is what will make it ultimately affordable for each member country. But how many billions? Okay, so for the SKA, the notional original sort of price tag for the SKA was something like 1.5 billion euros as a sort of total project. The sort of more recent estimates to say that it's going to be more than that, I would say. So people are looking more kind of maybe 3-4 billion euros for the SKA and trying to see how much of the telescope can be built for that figure. Why doesn't the state?
Why doesn't the United States want to be part of it?
Ah, okay. The US astronomy programs have already sort of committed themselves fairly heavily to other telescopes. So the US has a program called the sort of decadal survey, where every 10 years they list their priorities in astronomy and what parts of astronomy they're going to fund for their research. So the US has already committed to very strongly to something called ALMA, which is a high-frequency kind of radio telescope built in Chile, and they're a strong partner in that. And a lot of the funding is currently going into that. So I think until some of those other large programs are complete or more complete, they're unwilling to commit to a further large program. But we do hope that in the next decadal, so as a result, the SKA, as part of that thinking, wasn't rated extremely highly by the US decadal survey and wasn't funded. But we're hoping that in future decadal surveys that the SKA will actually be funded from the US as well, and they'll become one of the member countries of the SKA.
Where are the skills coming from? Do you have enough local skills?
Yes, we actually have a surprising pool of talent in South Africa, which has largely come from, in terms of technical expertise and things, has come from some of the industries I mentioned earlier, the arms industry, the petrochemical industry in particular. So some of those industries are no longer strongly supported by the government, and many of the engineers and things that were involved in those programs are now looking to kind of move into other areas, and the SKA is a very, very attractive thing. And they have many sort of relevant skills in terms of system engineering, how to build things in harsh environments, all kinds of things that are very useful for building a radio telescope. In addition, we have a fairly strong program to bring in kind of experts, particularly in the science area of the SKA, to take up chairs at the universities, and there's a couple of university chairs sponsored by the SKA project here at UCT and at other universities, which are sort of fairly substantial grants to bring in an international expert in some aspect of radio astronomy, be it the science or the technical development. Rhodes recently made an appointment as well. And those bring with them, with that funding, it builds up attracts a pool of PhD students and MSc students around that. So we've built up a lot of things sort of kind of from the ground up with a very good base, a very good resource base from other industries. I myself was doing radar imaging, which I did, which is kind of more kind of military or maybe a surveillance activity, which I did up at here at UCT before getting involved in this project. So it gives you the right kind of background. Sorry, there was a lady here who was next to me. Right. Okay, so the question is on intellectual property. How do we protect that given the investment that's happened here and all the developments? It's a very good question and quite a tricky one. The SK is developing an IP policy, intellectual property policy around this. And part of that is to register the IP that you've developed in bringing into the SK project. So you say, okay, this is IP which I've developed over here. I'm bringing it in, I'm making it available for the SK as a project to use. But nobody else within the SK sort of consortium or the members is allowed to commercialize it except the originating party that brought in that IP. So it's a matter of kind of keeping ownership where it belongs, but at the same time making that intellectual property available for science in this project. So you share it within the project, but it's nobody else is allowed to go and take it off and do other things with it. It's tricky. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't quite catch that. How far from the? Okay, so that's a very good question too. So where are we going to put all these people that are going to support the SK? Okay, at the dishes themselves, we try and keep as few people there as possible. We try and have people, so there may be some limited accommodation there, a couple of people stay there perhaps. We've got a support base currently 80 kilometers away, and for the full SK, this may be closer to kind of 30 kilometers away, kind of shielded behind some hills and things where the human activity can't affect the telescope as much. So some of the people may be housed there, and there may be kind of daytime operations there in particular. As I mentioned, the computing and things we also try and put behind the hills. In terms of the town of Carnarvon is our sort of next sort of biggest sort of place where people can stay, and there we do expect sort of people to be housed that are involved in SK maintenance and building and things. So some of it at the moment, let's say for Meerkat, we're expecting about 150 people actually involved on site doing construction, and we've got some construction camps and things on the site, but these are temporary structures, they get taken away again. Likewise for the SK, I guess there will be temporary structures also on site, which you'll just accept that there will be a degradation of what you can do scientifically while the construction is happening. And then you want to close this down as quickly as possible and move to a mode where the people aren't interfering so much. But still, there'll also have to be sort of substantial support structures for these people in the nearby towns and in places which are close enough to get to the telescope and not so close as to interfere. Once again, a difficult sort of logistical exercise. Yes?
Is Australia at the same level of development as we are here?
They will tell you that they are ahead. Yeah, no, it's, they're doing kind of different things in some aspects. So they're building something called the focal plane array system, the ASCAP system. And this is a quite challenging thing to build in a sort of technology sense. And so they've built some initial systems that they put on a couple of the antennas. So they've put up a system with, I think, about 36 antennas or so. And I'm not sure how many of them are populated with these focal plane arrays, but it's something like 6 or 7 at the moment. So it's difficult to kind of compare one activity with the other, but they've also spent a sort of substantial amount of time developing the site, getting it going, but they don't have as much infrastructure available close to their site. They don't have roads that are as sort of tar roads and whatever as close to their site as we do. They don't have power to their site, which is a bit of an issue that needs to be resolved. They put in a fiber optic cable and things. So, yeah, there's. I think it's just fair to say that there's activities happening in both countries in both ways. No, because the telescopes will be different that will be deployed in the different sites. There will be a central organization, the sort of so-called observatory, that will pull it all together, but the telescopes are likely to be able to operate independently. But having said that, we are working with the Australians quite closely in some areas, as a global project to pull this whole thing together. So we should move away from this idea of us and them. I know it was quite pervasive during the site bit phase, and maybe that's natural. But it is now moving towards more, it's a global endeavor, and it's not only South Africa and Australia, but all the partner countries have to pull together to make this thing work. So the question is about the configuration of the ISCAID, whether it should be put in a sort of east-west configuration versus north-south. It's a fairly sort of complicated trade-off there that you're trying to make. You actually rely on the Earth's rotation to fill in some of the gaps in the fact that you don't have one big dish. You've got a whole lot of small dishes. So we actually use the Earth rotation to do that. And if you wanted to do that in the... One way to do it is to make an east-west array, and then this whole thing sweeps around effectively as the Earth rotates, and you get what we call good sort of UV coverage of the sky, which gives you a good sort of sensitivity to different structures on the sky. But it also turns out that you want to make good sort of snapshot coverage. So instead of having to wait 8 hours to build up a picture, you want to be able to do that in 5 minutes with a lot of sensitivity. And so there you want to spread out your telescopes kind of more uniformly, or perhaps in a more random pattern, not so much because of the different kinds of atmospheres they're looking through, but just because of the mathematics of how you form an image from a radio telescope. So I think that's kind of a question we're going to have to take a bit offline, because it starts to get a bit technical. That's what you do. Yeah, you do store the information. That's correct. It's data signals coming over fiber optics going into a large amount of computing with storage. So there's a lot of, it's really digital signals. Okay, I think one more question and then we must, we've really long overcome. Oh, sorry, I should have explained that. Okay, the square kilometer array. So it turns out that the kind of science people are trying to do require a very sensitive instrument. And so people calculated that if you had a dish that was effectively 1 square kilometer in size, it would have enough sensitivity to do the kind of science that people were originally thinking of doing. So the way you do this practically is you have a whole lot of small dishes, and if you add up all their areas of all the small dishes, it makes up 1 square kilometer. So that's where the name originally came from. Whether it actually will be 1 square kilometer in the end is another matter. All right, thank you very much.